I am Paige Albiniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, I talk with director Ira Rosenzweig, who this year is up for 9 Promax Awards. We discuss how he got into directing, what brought him out to Los Angeles, how he gets work, and how he ended up focusing on comedy. We also dive a little bit into the details on projects he's done, such as a fun Nike campaign with Foot Locker and one of our favorite hotspots, It Takes Two, for Paramount Network's Lip Sync Battle, starring LL Cool J and Chrissy Teigen. Here's my chat with Ira.
Hello, Ira. Welcome. Thank you for chatting with me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Paige.
So I tend to start at the beginning with these conversations. So how did you get into – well, actually, let me introduce you first. So this is Ira Rosenzweig. He is a director. He has his own company, Wavemaker Creative. He does directing through them and also for other clients, which we will talk about. And he's done a lot of cool spots, which we will also talk about, and I will post in the story that runs along with this. But so let's start at the beginning. How did you get into directing initially?
It was kind of a roundabout way. I wasn't one of those kids who was like off with an 8mm camera at 10 years old making these films. I actually was a microbiology major in college and had no thought to do anything with filmmaking or advertising until pretty much my sophomore year. I on a whim just took a film production course and then kind of skipped organic chemistry for the next 2 months, and the rest is history. My parents were definitely not too thrilled, being that they thought I was going to be a doctor my whole life, pretty much. But I wouldn't say quickly, but they eventually came around, and that's pretty much how it happened.
What happened besides the fact that organic chemistry is terrible, what happened your sophomore year that sort of led you into that lured you into the directing direction?
I wasn't even really that into movies until maybe my junior or senior year of high school. And, once I went to college, I went to Penn State. I didn't even know they had a film production program. I grew up outside Philadelphia. And so I was really getting into independent films at the time. And I guess there was just kind of a light went off. And I was like, I'd love to try this just because I thought it would be fun. And I took this production course, it was Introduction to Production, and it was great because they just let you rent cameras and, you crewed up with your classmates. And as I was making these little shorts that I'd be, embarrassed to show anybody today, I just completely fell in love with it. I think I knew very quickly this is what I wanted to do. I just didn't think it was a practical decision. But ultimately, I think I went to my instructor at the end of the course. I said, hey, I really would love to know your opinion. Do you think it would be insane of me to choose this as a career path? She said, no, you'd be, doing yourself a disservice if you didn't. And that was it. So that's kind of what sparked it.
So at that time, without giving away your age, what kinds of equipment was available to you, and how is it different from what you work on today?
I'm happy to give away my age, but it was kind of the
you're a man, dawn. So it's fine.
It was kind of the dawn of DV technology. So there it was I'm trying to remember the exact names of the cameras, but it was like a Sony VX100, and there was a Panasonic that was really popular. I think the program
it was
got
digital
first,
at the time.
Exactly. Yeah, I think they got their first Avid 2 years before that. So it was really, everybody was kind of learning this stuff. But we had film cameras there, too. I shot my senior thesis film on 16mm, which was great, too.
And you were like, look at me, I'm Kurosawa. No.
Exactly, yeah.
So then so at the time when you were into independent films, what kinds of things were inspiring you, or what was sort of your dream path?
Trying to remember what the time I would have been. So I was probably, 1999 was kind of a seminal year, I think, filmmaking all at the same time, Magnolia and Eyes Wide Shut, American Beauty, Fight Club, all these amazing movies came out that year. I guess that was a little bit, that was right when I graduated. But those are the kinds of things that really inspired me. It's funny that I got into comedy in the end, because I really, at the beginning, thought I was going to be this very serious filmmaker. And my senior thesis was about a convicted child molester moving home, the entire story told through his POV. So it was, I never really thought much about comedy. I enjoyed comedy, but I didn't think I'd be making, you know, comedy content. And I just kind of fell into it and just really loved that as well.
I'm proud to say I have actually seen all those movies that you just mentioned.
Right, nice.
let's go into that. So what then pulled you into comedy?
So after I graduated, I moved back home, and through a very weird set of circumstances, I met this guy named John Falcon, who was a starving performance artist his entire life until he won $45 million in the New York lottery. I was actually introduced to him through my massage therapist. This sounds so crazy. My massage therapist, because I had a bad back and I was going to a chiropractor, and like one day a week, massage therapy was part of it. And she started telling me her best friend won $45 million in the lottery, and being this, I guess I was 21 at the time, I just said, just to make conversation, hey, do you think you'd be interested in funding a film? And never did I believe that it would actually lead to anything. A couple of weeks later, she said he wanted to meet me and wanted to see my films. And then it turned out he didn't want to fund any of the narratives that I wanted to do, but I convinced him that we should make a feature-length documentary about him. So we made a feature called One Man Show, a musical documentary, because he had a one-man show called A Short Puerto Rican Guy Sings Songs of Angst that we made the backbone of the film. So that was kind of my introduction to the whole thing. And I think I may have gotten off track. What was your question again?
How did you get into comedy?
So that's kind of that. There was a lot of comedy in the film. There's a lot of heartbreak in it as well. But I realized, okay, this is something that's interesting. But then a friend of mine was working at Spike TV at the time. And actually, he was started at Nickelodeon. So he got me a freelance gig producing and editing there. And then he moved over to Spike, and I started working over there. And they basically had a script that it was just a clip spot. I forget the exact project that it was, but I said to them, you know, I the script could use a little work. Do you mind if I rewrite it? And they said, fine. And so I did. And I, you know, they were like, wait a minute, this is now something that this is now a live action shoot. We have like a couple thousand dollars to do, you know, an all post job. And I said, look, I could do this very cheaply. Please let me do it. If you do, like, I'll do it for the budget. If you don't like it, I will pay for it. And then we'll just do the original idea. Luckily, they said, okay. And they really liked it. And I just very, you know, slowly became the go-to comedy guy at Spike. I always loved like funny commercials, but again, it wasn't something that I set out to do. But yeah, it just kind of, I guess I kind of lucked into it and realized I had a knack for doing it.
Did you actually work for Spike, or were you always freelance?
So I was permalance. I mean, I don't know if this really happens so much anymore, but I think from like the end of 2004 until maybe like 2008, then I was hired by MGM to write a feature script, and I left. But I was doing permalance work for Spike pretty much like full time. It's weird to say full time permalance, but I was for about 3 years or so.
No, I'm sort of that, so I know what that is.
Yeah.
So you've never actually been a real employee.
Well, that's not true. So I left and stopped doing the permalance work in 2008. And then in 2011, I actually went back to Spike full time. So from 2011 to 2014, I was actually a full time employee there.
Okay. So, and then you still work for Spike, which is now Paramount Network, which we'll talk about in a little bit.
But yeah, I do. I mean, I don't work for, I mean, I definitely still do projects for them.
Yeah,
some
you
of my
work
favorite
for them.
Things I've done in the last few years were for them. But yes, I still maintain a lot of relationships with the people I worked with there.
Okay. And then did you get your start in New York and then come out to LA, or did you come directly to LA from school?
No, I moved back home to Philadelphia, and then I think in 2002 I moved to New York when I started making this documentary. And then in 2014, my wife, she's pretty amazing. She called me, and she just, I was sitting at my desk. I remember this pretty vividly. And she's like, you're miserable. We're moving to LA. let me backtrack a little bit to explain, how this came about. So I got, film and TV representation, you know, a few years before that. And my reps were always saying, you got to move to LA. You know, it's going to be hard to get you work if you're not out here. And so my problem was always that my wife, she's a very successful litigator and had her own practice. And it was, you know, we knew that if we moved to LA, it would really damage her, possibly destroy her business. And so we were always kind of reluctant to do it because of that. But I was not exactly the best. I'm not perfectly cut out for corporate America in that sense. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't, you know, while I enjoyed a lot of the projects I was doing at Spike and working with some of the people that I was working with, work being full time at a corporation was not for me. And so my wife basically sacrificed her career for me and we moved out to LA. She's amazing, obviously. So that's kind of how it all happened.
All right, let's follow up on that though. Then did she go with a firm in LA or what happened?
So she continued actually with all of her New York clients. None of them dropped her, shockingly, knowing that she was out here. She just continued to do work for them. Had to go back to New York a lot to go to court. But, she continues to practice and has her own firm out here.
Okay. So it wasn't like the biggest sacrifice, ultimately. Just saying.
No. And yeah. Well, things definitely changed for her. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously a lot harder for her to practice out here when she does have New York clients.
Yeah. Okay. But since we're not doing an interview about your wife, I'll proceed on. So, and then did you feel like that moving to LA was, I mean, obviously it seems like it was something that made you happier, but also set your career in a different direction. So when you came out to LA, what was the difference? What were the changes?
Oh, I mean, honestly, it's night and day. It's funny because I always thought, like, you know, New York, there's a lot of work in LA, but I figured there's just almost as much as work in New York. And I really have seen that that is not the case at all. I mean, to be completely fair, I don't know if I was putting so much emphasis on finding, projects to direct in New York because I was full time at Spike. There were a few things I had done on the side, but, you know, that wasn't my main thrust at the time, though it probably should have been. But like when I moved out here, I think for the first 2.5 months, I don't think I made a penny. Like I was just networking my ass off and just constantly trying to meet people. And then one day it just took off. And luckily I've really been in a position where I haven't looked for work. I don't know, maybe at least over a year, things have just been complete, you know, a constant stream of business, which is really incredible.
So, and then when you came out, did you start Wavemaker Creative right when you got here, or what was the thinking behind starting that?
So it's funny, like a friend of mine, there was a job that came up at, it was Gawker, which is now defunct, but they had a 20 episode web series that my friend was producing. And she said, you know, I think you're perfect to direct this. Who would you want to produce it? And I actually went to a company that I had been directing through a production company out here. And they said they were too busy to do it. So I thought to myself, you know what, like, what is a production company? You need a great producer, you need insurance, you need payroll. That's it. Why can't I do it myself? And so that's exactly what I did. I already had a corporation registered and I brought on an EP inline producer. I got all those other things that I was talking about and just produced the job through my company. It was a $500,000 job, which was pretty big, I think, for a first gig. It was like a 4 or 5 day shoot. And then we did all the posts on it. And I was just like, you know, this is totally something that is sustainable. And in a lot of ways, I thought it was a great move because I don't really love putting my fate in other people's hands. And I was actually on a roster many years ago, and they got me, that production company got me like one job in the entire year, and I was exclusive to them. And now having a family, like, that would obviously destroy my life. So I've just kind of kept going with the model now of, you know, I love doing, I think last year I directed 20 things. 5 of them were through Wavemaker, just from relationships that I have. The other 15 or so were through 8 or 9 other production companies that I've worked with. And I just, you know, that kind of model is something that I probably will continue doing.
Yeah. Can you discuss that model? So, because I've done stories about directors, like, they signed to be, you know, for exclusive representation at X or Y production company. So, mm-hmm. And obviously you're sort of short-circuiting that traditional model. So how does that work for you, and how do you navigate it with the production companies?
Sure. So, You know, the well, first, I guess I could start with the second part. How I navigate with production companies is that I tell everyone basically, like, if you'd like to work with me, it's really on a first come, first serve basis. And what that means is, so like, it's, you know, it's different for promos and commercials, and I kind of do an equal amount of both. But with commercials, the work is coming from agencies. They usually contact sales reps, who then contact production companies and send them those boards and say, which directors do you think are right for this job? I have a unique situation where I know a lot of sales reps, and so they'll directly send me those boards and say, you know, have you been submitted yet on this? If not, we love to submit Wavemaker. So that's the first way it happens. And if I haven't been submitted, I'll say, sure, go ahead and submit me. A lot of times though, I also have these production company relationships. So they'll call me, and, you know, different reps get different boards. So a lot of times there's overlap, and sometimes like only one entity will contact me about a certain job. And so let's say it's a production company. They'll ask if I've been submitted, and I'll say, if I haven't, I'll say, no, I haven't. Go ahead and submit me. And then if they get it, then I'm directing through them. I really, you know, it's really not so important to me whether we're, right. You know, I'm directing a job through my company or through another company, as long as the job is done right.
Right. So, I mean, ultimately, it seems like the work is the same. It's just the path is sometimes a little different.
Exactly. And the thing is, you know, there's the quality between production companies in general, and certainly in the promo space, I think there's a wide range. And I just think whenever I'm able to do it through my own company, I'm assured that, like, obviously, like, sometimes I'll disagree with the way the money's being allocated or with the approach to production. And this way, it's just a lot easier to control that stuff and kind of do it in the way that I think is best. And also, it kind of usually affords more access to the creatives at the networks, because I really love getting involved at the idea level if possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, so that was a question I had too. So I was watching... you did the Nike Foot Locker Discover Your Air campaign, and then mm-hmm. Some other stuff. But let's talk about that a little bit. So on something sure. like that, which, again, I'll put some of those spots in the story, but how at what level do you get involved, and how much control do you have over sort of the basic creative, like the writing, the direction, not the direction, but do you know what I mean? Like setting up the premise,
sure.
all of that.
Yeah, so that project was really unique. I mean, we were awarded that project. So Wavemaker produced that campaign that was produced and post-produced it. So that was, you know, like an over $1 million campaign. It was a five-day shoot. And we had 15 spots.
Yeah,
15 spots with a ton of influencer talent. And all those spots, like, we finished shooting on a Friday. And then 2 weeks later, we had to have delivered all 15 spots.
Oh,
and they
God.
Were rolling. I mean, it was a crazy experience. But so with that, we were awarded like 2 weeks before the shoot, which honestly was not enough time, but we just kind of powered through it. I think even a week before the shoot, we found out that we were supposed to be shooting at a Foot Locker, and it turned out that we couldn't anymore, and we had to build the entire retro Foot Locker on a stage, and like with the ceiling and everything. So like that was a nice curveball that was thrown at us. But it was a killer project.
That's insane,
really,
huh?
Yeah, I'm really happy with how it turned out. But like, no, so they sent me an initial deck that I think there were a few scripts written in that, and most of them were just at the idea stage. Then to credit all the writers at the agency, which was Laundry Service in New York, you know, they wrote everything, but they were very welcoming with my feedback. So we'd have a lot of back and forth about, how I would say, you know what, this spot's really good, but this could be better about it. And sometimes we kind of started from scratch again. Over those 2 weeks, just kind of continued to refine the creative. And then I had three editors working pretty much round the clock, and I would just bounce back and forth to their rooms. And we were coloring and mixing all at the same time. It was pretty crazy, but a great learning experience nonetheless.
Yeah, again, I'll post some of these spots in the story, but just so if people are listening to this, like there's definitely posts in it, there's definitely effects in it, like it's not just a straight shoot either.
No, there were a lot of stunts, there was like a scoreboard, an anthropomorphic scoreboard breaking out of a wall and dancing, like a lot of choreography. We had, it was a really intense campaign, but that was another one of those things that just kind of proved to myself, like, you know, we bring it on. we can do anything if we put our mind to it.
Okay. And then another spot that you guys, or really you did, was the lip sync battle spot with Chrissy Teigen and LL Cool J, It Takes Two. This mm-hmm. we ran as a hot spot, so I've put it on Brief before, but I'll also post it again here. But let's talk about that one, how that came together, and at what point you came in on the creative.
Sure. So with Paramount, I have an interesting relationship in that, you know, I did the Alec Baldwin spot for them that won a bunch of awards a couple of years ago for One Night Only. And I've done so much for them over the years that some of the producers there and the creative directors, they'll kind of even call me as they're coming up with the idea or even before they know what they're doing and say, hey, we have a big shoot coming up. Are you available? Would you be interested? And so with It Takes Two, there was actually, I probably shouldn't reveal what the other idea was, but initially they said it was either going to be this It Takes Two music video or we would be doing like a parody of a big film franchise. And so they were very different creatives. And at first, to be honest, I was actually hoping that the other one would go through. But in the end, because the other one was just, the idea was It Takes Two was just a, it was just said, this is, it's a music video. So I had no idea what it would entail. But then we found out that we couldn't do the other idea. And so a good friend of mine, Brian Treshon, is a writer at Paramount, and I guess he's the editorial director. And so we started talking about different ideas for it. He wrote a script up for what we ended up shooting. And, the great thing with Paramount is they do afford me a lot of creative freedom. So we didn't know exactly what it was going to be. We thought there was a rough outline of, I'm trying to remember how it came in. I think it just said, you know, the script said that we started in an old record store and then we transitioned into a fantasy with Chrissy and LL. So in concert with the Paramount team, we kind of came up with this idea to kind of do this all like white with pink and blue neons, kind of like a retro future kind of idea. It's a little bit futuristic, but it's made kind of futuristic in the mind of somebody who might be living in 1980s because Chrissy is kind of working in this record store to start. So that's really how it came about. That was great because I also edited the spots. That's an interesting thing. So not only do I, you know, do productions through Wavemaker and through other production companies, but Paramount's a unique situation where Viacom likes to keep a lot of the production internal. So they produced it internally and hired me to direct it, but not only that, then edit it. And then I took it all the way through post. So I brought it through company three to color and Beacon mm-hmm. Street to mix. So saw it through all the way.
I think also a thing that's interesting, both about the Discover Your Air campaign and the It Takes Two video is, and I think this is where the comedy background comes into play, is in both of those, there's these little touches that are funny that I think probably weren't in the original conception or even in the specific script. But it just seems like there are things that came in later that you're like, oh, this could be good. I don't know. I just noticed that it ends up raising the level of the comedy, I think.
Well, thank you. And, you know, without knowing exactly what you're referencing, I guess I'll just take credit for it. But it's very possible.
I know. Well, the problem is I don't have it in front of me, so I don't know specifically what I'm referencing. But I know that because I watched that It Takes Two spot many times, actually. And so I remember there just being like little things in the background that were going on that were just funny. But you're like, at the time I wondered, like, were they told to do that or what happened there that, brought,
right.
you know, that made that happen?
Right. I mean, I think one of the main things about one of the comic points is John Witherspoon, and I fought really hard to get him to play the record store owner who then comes back and is dancing in the second part. And luckily, the folks at Paramount thought that was a great idea too.
Yeah, that's a good example. Like that guy's just in the back, sort of getting down, and it's funny. Another spot that you did that we ran, which I don't know why we ran because we generally don't do movies, but the Neighbors 3 Zombies Rising one with. We did it because it was Walking Dead, so that was TV.
Right.
So it was with Seth Rogen and Zac Efron, and that one was super popular on our social.
Oh, great. Yeah, that was really
fun. Yeah, people seem to really love it. But that brings me to the next question, which is, I mean, and it says this in some of the background material I was given, but, and I know this is true in general, so you do a lot of shoots with celebrities, and usually they're available mm-hmm. for like 14 seconds. So can you just sort of talk about how you deal with that challenge?
Yeah. So, I mean, talking specifically about Neighbors, that was part of a junket day. So we were one of I guess, four networks that were shooting with Seth Rogen and Zac Efron. And so we knew we had an hour, but that actually shrunk down to 40 minutes of shooting time because we had a couple of wardrobe changes. You know, we brought them to a couple of different areas to shoot. So the challenge became, you know, how are we going to pull off all the shots we need in 40 minutes? So that's really the biggest challenge working with celebrities. I mean, sometimes I'm given, like with the Peyton Manning Super Bowl spot, you know, I had him for like 8 hours or something like that, and that's amazing.
Well, he's but got nothing them, to you know, do now, so just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm but, in Denver, so I have things to say about Peyton.
Oh, right. But, yeah, so I just said, look, okay, we need to get two cameras, and we need to be really efficient with what we shoot here. Like, because I'm involved in the edits or I'm personally editing it, like, I in my head know exactly what we need, so there's no need to overshoot it. So I think, you know, we probably did three, like, and we did a lot of improv. Like, knowing how great they are at improv, I didn't want to lock them into a script. So we went through the script kind of as scripted the first time, and then I just told them to go with it. So we covered, I think first we shot kind of like a wide and a medium in the first setup, and then the second setup, we just got the close-ups. And so we finished shooting with them, and the way we designed it was we then doubled them so they could leave, and then we could shoot all the coverage with the zombie. So like, you just have to get creative with the way you're approaching the shoot. Like Alec Baldwin, when we did the One Night Only, I mean, that was like a 90-second thing. He had a ton of copy, but I think we only had him for less than an hour. So it becomes really imperative to know exactly what you need.
I mean, just for perspective, this interview has been 26 minutes. So in 14 minutes, you need to conclude shooting your spot with Seth Rogen and Zac Efron, which is not that much time.
No, it's not much time at all. And, you know, it's tricky working with celebrities sometimes. Like, you know, sometimes they're sweet as pie. Other times they're not having a great day. And you've got to learn how to manage those personalities, too, and learn when that kind of you need to have a backbone and defend the creative and defend, you know, the network executives who are trying to get this thing done. And there are other times where you need to know you're not going to get anywhere with this and you need to back off. So it's a real balancing act.
Was that the hardest part? Because I've always heard that it can be very challenging working with celebrities for all those reasons.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is definitely challenging. Sometimes you get lucky and somebody is really into it and like you can really shape the performance and you know, they may come in thinking they're going to do it one way and you say, you know what, I had an idea. Why don't we try this? And they're up for doing it. Other times they want to do what they want to do. So you really just have to read the room and figure it out. And it's, you know, it's sometimes that's frustrating because I love nothing more than like, I'm crazy about casting. Like I'll go to the first session sometimes and the end callbacks and I'll agonize over who to pick. And it's because in casting, I'm telling them to do it a million different ways because I want to know that they're capable of shifting if need be. So it's definitely difficult sometimes working with some bigger names who just, you know, feel like they're going to do what they're going to do. But, you know, in the end, it usually works out.
Do you feel like over the 5 years you've been in LA, maybe this was true in New York too, but you've developed like certain skills or special gifts or anything that sort of gives you the ability to work with, you know, like you sort of know that, I don't know, it's like a celebrity whisperer.
I'll take the title if that's what you want to bestow upon me.
I'm asking you. I don't know.
I don't think there's any kind of like secret sauce. I think, you know, the more you do something, the more you become comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. I remember I used to stay up like I wouldn't be able to sleep the nights before shoots. And, you know, when I started out doing this and I was just so nervous, it's like I just think preparation is really key. And now I'm just comfortable doing it. And it kind of just works. I mean, I think you just have to establish like an immediate rapport if possible with people. And it's great to have a phone call with them before the shoot. A lot of times that doesn't happen. And they just like, I'm doing something on set and all of a sudden they're walking out and I have to switch gears and then, you know, introduce myself. And that's not always the best way to approach it. But yeah, I think the more rapport you have ahead of time. And I've also worked with, it's funny, a lot more now this is happening. Like a network or a company will want me to direct something with a big name, and they'll, you know, they first send my work to that person and their team, and they vet me, and then sometimes they'll want to have a call. And honestly, I think to other people that may sound like a pain in the ass, I think it's great. Like I would much prefer that situation.
Oh, that seems better to me too. I mean, and you had a pre-existing relationship, like in the case of the Neighbors 3 Zombies Rising spot, you had a pre-existing relationship with Seth, right? Because you had done some stuff with him for AMC.
I hadn't. That was the first time I worked with him. And then 2 weeks later, AMC asked me to direct him again for the Preacher parody.
Oh, okay. So it was the flip. It was the reverse.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. That coming in cold seems really, I kind of know what you're talking about just from even doing stuff like this. So you can come in cold and you can have chemistry and it works, or it can be like, doesn't really flow. But it does seem, totally. Especially with celebrities, because I think trust is a big deal for them. So if they're like, well, I don't really know you guy and you're directing me and this applies to my brand, I can see where that is challenging.
Right. And you know what the other thing is, and it's funny because I've talked to other people, and I know a lot of directors when working with celebrities, they're more kind of yes men and women and just kind of let them, I don't know if it's intimidation, but they just kind of don't assert themselves.
Yes.
I found that celebrities like react much, like when I actually have an opinion and I give them a note and tell them, you know, or say, you know what, maybe that didn't work so well, I think we could do it better. They immediately respect you more, and they're much more willing to go further with what they're doing. So I think they're actually looking for somebody to kind of, not to stand up to them, but
I think confidence breeds confidence, right?
Yeah.
Like if you seem confident, then they feel confident. If you seem like you don't know what you're doing, they're like, what am I in for here?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, and I mean, maybe that's the secret celebrity whisperer gift.
There you go.
So what do you have coming up that's cool?
What do I have coming up? So I'm actually working with Paramount Network on Monday. I'm doing it's funny, I've done a number of Dish Network spots. I've done I've done a couple for AMC for The Walking Dead, and now I did one for Paramount Network last year for Dish and Yellowstone, and this is the 2019 edition of that. Mm-hmm. So
Yellowstone
that's on Monday.
Not funny. Just so you know,
I'm aware, but luckily Paramount is like, they like kind of tweaking their properties a little bit in the spot. So this will hopefully be funny.
Okay.
And it's set in the world of Yellowstone. I probably shouldn't give too much away.
Yeah. Big spoiler, everyone.
And then I'm bidding on a few other jobs through Wavemaker that one of them will hopefully happen the very end of this month with a celebrity. I probably shouldn't reveal too much about these things.
Okay.
But then I'm also, you know, in the feature and TV game, and those things take forever to get going, but fingers crossed the movie looks like it might be moving forward soon. So
yeah, that's what I was going to ask you is, you know, going back to college and my jokes about Kurosawa, just for, to be honest, I've never seen a movie by him, but I know he's a thing. But do you have those dreams still? Like, do you still think I would like to do a feature?
For sure.
You do, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, I've had a number of things that have gotten, like, oh so close. Like, you know, we had a $2 million budget. We raised, I think it was, like, up to $1.6 million with foreign pre-sales, and then it just all fell apart, like an actor fell out. That's happened to me a few times, and getting long-form stuff going is really, really frustrating. At least it has been for me. But I'm definitely continuing to plug away, not with just with features, but with TV. And the cool thing is there's now a lot of, like, interactive stuff. I don't know if you saw Bandersnatch, the
yes,
Black Mirror Choose Your Own Adventure on Netflix. So there's a few things I'm involved with in that sense. I actually did a Choose Your Own Adventure like commercial for Walmart last year, which was a really cool experience. So I'm hoping to do more of that stuff as well.
Yeah, that seems like a kind of a whole new field to get into. And I mean, if anything, I mean, it's amazing to me if features even ever get made, frankly, but in this world, there's so much content, it just seems limitless.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it seems like a lot of opportunity for you.
For sure. With the feature world, I probably said no to more than I should have. I've always been like, oh, I just want to wait until that like perfect first feature comes around. But yeah, it would be nice to make a movie.
Yeah, maybe you just have to take the dive at some point.
Exactly.
Okay, I think that's it. Thank you so much, Ira. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Paige. This was really fun.
Yeah, and I will talk to you. Hopefully I'll run into you or talk to you again soon.
All right, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Ira. Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Paige Albiniak is editorial director at Promax. Andres Trujillo, Promax's social media and community manager, edited this podcast. Video helper provided the music. Digital content producers Kate LeCayer-Marion and Kayla Marie Hardaway contribute to Daily Brief. You can hit us up on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Promax_global. You can also email us at dailybrief@promax.org. And please subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.